for July 9th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Fedor.
And we are back again with another adventure from the Casebook of Sherlock Holmes. This one, The Adventure of the Three Gables.
Yes, it is. Let's start our discussion with a few disclosures. This story is a product of its time. The language and caricatures used by Arthur Conan Doyle are unfortunate and not proper for today's audiences. We will be discussing the story for completeness, knowing that our audience recognizes the racial depictions used by the author do not reflect the values of our host or her listeners. And as we were kind of, I was reading about this, I was thinking of some contemporary writings that may have influenced Doyle and the story. In 1876, the Atlanta Constitution published the first Uncle Remus short story by Joel Chandler Harris. Characters like Br'er Rabbit and Mr. Fox were widely popular. The stories used a Southern United States regional dialect and were meant to capture the African-American oral tradition. Collections of these stories were published from 1881 to 1948. Stories with themes and dialects like this can be problematic for today's audiences. For an example, Disney's Song of the South movie, based on the Uncle Remus short stories, will not be re-released in the United States. Disney World Splash Mountain, which also uses the Uncle Remus tales and songs, will be replaced shortly by the more contemporary The Princess and the Frog. And just an additional curiosity, Neil Gaiman's Annecy Boys features a historical and mischievous character based on the West African spider god, and that may have been the inspiration for the tricky African-American Br'er Rabbit. So all this is just kind of background to try to explain Doyle's problematic character and dialect. So let's begin and kind of discuss the story.
Mark Twain, of course, well known for having problematic dialect. And I'll just remind you guys that Mark Twain in the late 1880s wrote a Sherlock Holmes pastiche. And so I imagine that Doyle would have read Twain. I mean, everybody read Twain, but especially since he had the double-barreled mystery starring Sherlock Holmes and referencing, obviously, that wonderful moment in The Sign of Four that we read rather recently, where Watson tells Mary about picking up a double-barreled tiger cub and shooting a musket. So Twain is another potential reference to think about. But thank you so much, Chip, for setting all that up for us. That's really important. Now, let me ask before we jump totally into the story, just straight up gut feelings. Did you guys like this story? Why or why not? Steve, I know you've been loving our collection of the case. I know the Casebook of Sherlock Holmes is your new favorite book. So let's...
this is problematic dialect, 100%. This is absolutely racist, pointing out the differences between African Americans and this English group, and it's offensive, and I don't like it. But even beyond that, the mystery of this story is boring. There's no meat to this mystery. This is not the Sherlock Holmes that we have come to love in the 98 different days that we've discussed Sherlock Holmes. This is a boring mystery.
Oh, didn't we also get a depiction of Italians in this too?
So yes.
It's not just... Doyle's like equal opportunity in this story. I guess we could praise it for having the bad person or the person that we are concerned about being a female, because there's not many of them for Doyle to use. So I think that this, if you were going to retell this story for a modern audience, let's say you were going to do a television show or something like that, you certainly could work with the bones, and you certainly may have an interesting protagonist.
Yeah, I really like that. I think that the adversary is great, but she doesn't appear until the last three pages, right? And we just know that there's someone behind everything, but we don't know who it is. And then when she appears, she's super cool, but then she's gone before we even meet her. Now, so one thing I've been finding, because you guys, I haven't read the Casebook in years and years, and it has been interesting because the stories are definitely weaker than the 48 stories that precede these 12, or the 46 stories that precede these 12. But I'm kind of, now I understand where Laurie R. King, who's my favorite pastiche writer with the Mary Russell stories, where she's coming from. Because I feel like what Doyle did with Watson and Holmes is set up these amazing characters. And then he kind of fell flat at the end. And what Laurie R. King does is she takes the elderly Holmes and makes him awesome again. Okay. So I, as I'm reading, I'm feeling how these are sort of flat stories. And I take your point completely, Steve, that this mystery isn't awesome, but it has the potential to be awesome.
I agree.
And I'm going to argue that as we talk through it. And so, you know, I'm sorry, but like that scrap of paper is so much fun. And in Laurie R. King's hands, it would be a super fun mystery. So I think we still have to give Doyle like a lot of credit, but he's a little bit, despite his warm words in the preface to the casebook, he feels to me like he's a little bit past writing Holmes at this point.
So let's begin Indiana Jones begin. And the Sorry. Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
And they're making another one too. And it's like, it just hurts my childhood to think of it.
Oh, I tease. Let's get started.
All right, you guys. The good news about the mystery of the Three Gables is that we have our narrator back, Watson. Watson, he's part of the story. He's even like flailing around with a poker, so it's good. So he begins the story by saying, "I don't think that any of my adventures with Mr. Sherlock Holmes opened quite so abruptly or so dramatically as that which I associate with the Three Gables." And then he tells us that Holmes is feeling pretty cheerful. Watson has just sat down in his favorite armchair, and in comes the visitor. And the visitor is an offensively drawn black man, Steve Dixon. You know, you guys, this isn't the first time Watson has told us that this is the most dramatic of all openings. We've had a million dramatic openings to these stories, and more dramatic and less offensive than this one.
But this is very abrupt. He walks in and he starts in yelling at Holmes about how he's going to potentially harm him if he does the wrong things here. This is pretty abrupt. There's no introduction from Mrs. Hudson. There's no card that's sent. This is definitely
send up his visitor's card. You're right.
This is definitely 1920s as opposed to the late 1800s.
That's right, because one of our most dramatic guys was that big guy who came in and then fainted dead away, remember? And they had to, like, give him brandy and soda, and then he realized he hadn't eaten all day. So it's true, like, that was a gentleman fainting in the drawing room. And this is, you know, a big African-American man, like, ready to beat up Holmes. Mm-hmm. And so Holmes pushes this guy verbally, right? And it's interesting to see Watson's role in this. He says, "It may have been the icy coolness of my friend, or it may have been the slight clatter which I made as I picked up the poker. In any case, our visitor's manner became less flamboyant." So we have Watson in the corner picking up the poker. Holmes questions the visitor, Steve Dixon, and he ends up leaving in a hurry. Without waiting for any further questioning, our visitor bolted out of the room almost as precipitately as he had entered. Holmes knocked out the ashes of his pipe with a quiet chuckle. "I'm glad you were not forced to break his head, Watson. I observed your maneuvers with the poker."
Yes, you know, I was prepared, sir. I was prepared. Right?
Elderly Watson and Holmes. Holmes still has all of his arrogance, all of his confidence, and Watson is just like quietly sitting in the background, weapon in hand, just in case it's needed.
And Sherlock has his ability to soothe people as well. His words, in part, soothe this man's flamboyance. And I like that word in that sentence. He was exuberant over what he was going to do, how this was going to go. And Sherlock just sat there and calmly explained in words and changed the guy's mind. We've seen that before in Sherlock.
Absolutely. And showed that he's not to be messed with.
At the same time.
He changed the guy's mind in two ways. Mm-hmm. Like, want to get involved messing with me, and let's relax, right? So Steve, you should tell us about the case because you were so impressed by it.
Yes, we turn to the case here. Miss Mary Maberly. Okay, good naming convention, Doyle, has too good an offer on her home. It turns out not only does the buyer want to buy her home, but absolutely everything in it. She's not allowed to take anything out of the house. This is mysterious at least, and really unusual at best.
And it turns out Mrs. Maberly, who's a widow, has recently lost her son, Douglas Maberly, and he had died of pneumonia last month while he was an attaché in Rome. And so his belongings have just been sent home.
Yeah,
so,
great mystery.
That's not mysterious at all. That's not mysterious. This incredible offer and dead son's belongings. I don't know where the mystery is going to be, Steve. I don't know where.
As avid mystery readers, we are flummoxed by this case. Here's where it would have been so much better, because that part is so obvious. But like, what it is in the belongings is actually super cool. Now, here we get the case of the bad servant. And you guys, have we had any bad servants since the butler did it all the way back like 40 stories ago?
I don't think so.
You're right.
I feel like our servants have been surprisingly on the up and up. So.
Well, Doyle certainly hasn't grabbed that trope yet.
But he did. He created that trope way back when, but he didn't rely upon it as the trope. Interesting.
Huh. Right. So now, I think this, I thought this scene was really interesting, and I loved the writing here. Steve, you might disagree with me, but Mrs. Maberly is telling her story to Holmes and Watson. They're in the drawing room of the Three Gables. And then, quote, "Here we had a very extraordinary interruption. Holmes raised his hand for silence. Then he strode across the room, flung open the door, and dragged in a great gaunt woman whom he had seized by the shoulder. She entered with ungainly struggle, like some huge awkward chicken, torn squawking out of its coop." And so we can picture this woman perfectly, right?
Yeah.
And so
let me go ahead and do this. Aha! Got you.
Right? Goodness.
And Holmes gets totally schoolmarmy with Susan the bad servant. He says she's too wheezy to be sneaking around because he's breathing through the door. And he says, "Now, Susan, wheezy people may not live long, you know. It's a wicked thing to tell kids. Whom did you tell?" And Susan will not give up her connection. She says, "I'll see you in hell first." To which Holmes replies, "Oh, Susan, language." Like, come on. Since when did you become like the language police? And she's like, "You know what? I'm leaving. I'm leaving this job." "Goodbye, Susan," says Holmes. "Paregoric is the stuff." And so I was like, not surprised. Of course, I had to look up paregoric. It's a patent medicine from the time. It is from the opiate family, and it's used for both diarrhea and for cough. And so he was giving her a little bit of medical advice on her way out, since she does obviously have some sort of pulmonary thing going on. She take a medication so that she wouldn't be so easy to catch due to her wheezy breathing.
Moral opium and things from the opiate family solve everything.
So we're being offensive to African Americans and Italians later, and now the asthmatics. Great.
The asthmatic among us.
and the one character's name, Steve. Okay, I think this show is over.
Okay. Don't forget about Barney Stockdale. Realizes that Steve Dixie's boss, Barney Stockdale, is possibly behind it. But Sherlock thinks there's someone even behind Barney.
What? There could be another mystery.
Now we get this moment, which, sorry, we're just making too much fun of this. We get this moment where Susan leaves. And so then Holmes summarizes the situation for Mrs. Maberly. And he says, "No, as I read it, there is something which you do not know that you have and which you would not give up if you did know. That is how I read it," said I. Dr. Watson agrees, so that settles it.
Yes! I love that line. That one made me laugh. I was like, oh, my friend agrees with me, so therefore that must be the case. He's the smart one here. What?
Has Watson ever had a thought? I mean, come on.
The friend who's the perfect helpmate because he never sees anything.
Watson agrees. Isn't that so?
You know, well,
I'll answer for him. He does too.
When Holmes narrated his own story, he was like, "Guys, I miss Watson because Watson always makes the wrong move, which helps me see them. So anyway, now, all right, guys. Okay, we're still making fun of the story. Now, what about Dale Pike? You'll notice that in these later stories, Holmes does have a number of different informants, right? And they all have great names. So a couple stories ago, we had the underworld informant. Here we have the more social society pages informant. So Langdale Pike was his human book of reference upon all matters of social scandal. This strange, languid creature spent his waking hours in the bow window of a St. James Street club and was the receiving station as well as the transmitter for all gossip of the metropolis. Holmes discreetly helped Langdale to knowledge and on occasion was helped in turn. So interestingly, given who our characters have been, right? Steve Dixie, like this bruiser henchman type, Susan the bad servant, are we really expecting like this is some sort of society pages gossip situation?
It doesn't seem that way.
Curious, right?
Right.
Right. And well, again,
inquiring mind want to know.
Mm-hmm. But this could have been done so, so well, but it wasn't. But like the idea that you have, you know, the idea that there's whoever is behind this is someone who's in the society pages, someone whom Langdale Pike would be keeping an eye on. Like, we don't see where that's coming from, and there really are no clues to this point. Now we get the burglary, and Mrs. Maberly gets chloroformed. And so, did I miss it, or did the police officer never get a name in this story?
I don't know if he did. Holmes says, I'll be back tomorrow, and check out that package that your son sent you before he passed away.
And he also says to maybe have someone stay in the house with her, because he says, Mrs. Maberly, she might be in some danger. And of course, the next day, they get the telegram that there's been a burglary, and...
I'm shocked.
Has been chloroformed.
And she was shocked. She was like apologizing. You told me to have somebody stay with me. I didn't. And who knew there would be a burglary? We told you to find somebody to stay with you.
Now, when they meet the local police, and the local police inspector, I believe, is not even named, they feel like they don't need Holmes's help. That we've seen this before. Within, we met a gray old gentleman who introduced himself as the lawyer, together with a bustling, rubicund inspector who greeted Holmes as an old friend. Well, Mr. Holmes, no change for you in this case, I'm afraid. Just a common, ordinary burglary, and well within the capacity of the poor old police. No experts need apply. And as soon as a police officer tells us that, right, we know there's something more behind the case. Now, I thought that Holmes seemed really genuinely solicitous of Mrs. Maberly. He's like, oh my goodness, you don't look well. Obviously, you've been chloroformed. We don't have to do this right now. And then he engages her in a conversation and is like, so what would you do if you got like a great price for your house? What is your dream, retired elderly woman? What would you like to do with your life? It's a little bit out of character for Holmes to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But
here, have a brandy. Course. Let me ask you some questions about your future. If you could dream anything, what would you like?
Right.
Well, right. And he's sort of doing like, what would your ideal retirement look like? Right?
This is so strange. This is so Doyle in his 60s from his perspective looking at retirement and thinking about the future. And it's just, it doesn't make any sense to the character of Sherlock Holmes here.
Except... it totally does, Steve.
It wraps up with a bow. Come on, man.
It's a bow. Because... it's a bow.
It totally makes sense because, of course, Holmes realizes at this by this point, Holmes knows exactly who's behind this and what it's about. And he's like, what do I want to get for this woman? Right? He's not going to be turning this over to the police. So he's already negotiating. When he asks her those questions, we're like, Holmes, since when are you retirement planner, buddy? But he's already thinking, when I negotiate this, I'm going to get what this person wants. She wants to take a trip around the world. That's her dream. We'll make it happen for her. So then our unnamed inspector is like, oh man, here's a mysterious piece of paper that clearly means nothing.
I think that was a direct quote from the text right there.
Oh. Well, no, sorry. I'll give you the quote, because the quote is so much more funnier than what I just said. So Mrs. Maberly says, "There was one sheet of paper which I may have torn from the man that I grasped. It was lying all crumpled on the floor. It is in my son's handwriting." "Which means that it is not of much use," said the inspector. "Now, if it had been the burglars..." "Exactly," said Holmes. "What rugged common sense. Nonetheless, I should be curious to see it." So this is even... So you guys, I love the rugged common sense, right?
Right.
So, this is page 245. It's a numbered page. And there's only a very brief but mysterious piece of writing on it. And this is great. I love this. It starts... ... "Face bled considerably from the cuts and blows, but it was nothing to the bleeding of his heart as he saw that lovely face, the face for which he had been prepared to sacrifice his very life, looking out at his agony and humiliation. She smiled. Yes, by heaven, she smiled, like the heartless fiend she was. And as he looked up at her, it was at that moment that love died and hate was born. Man must live for something. If it is not for your embrace, my lady, then it shall surely be for your undoing and my complete revenge."
Did we need to have some kind of disclosure before reading that? That is so powerful.
That's the best writing in this mystery, for sure.
You guys are so mean. This is typical over-the-top Victorian melodrama, mm-hmm. right? I mean, super familiar. We've got the evil woman, this poor man who was prepared to sacrifice anything for her, and now he's turning to revenge. And Holmes's reaction is great. He says, "Queer grammar. Did you notice how the he suddenly changed to my?" And I'm going to be honest. I feel like if we had had the scrap of paper at the beginning of the mystery, we could have had a really good story here. And that's the invitation. I mean, obviously, it's not great writing. I'm completely agreeing. But that's actually kind of great, this scrap of paper. Mm-hmm. And who's behind it is great. I don't know what we've been doing these past 10 pages, because it was not great. But this final segment is kind of awesome. Holmes is getting all literary critic. He's noticing a shift from third to first person. And he's completely right. And he knows exactly who's behind it. We just don't see any of the work to get to what's behind, right? We're just like, he's like, "Well, Watson... By the way, Watson, I suppose you see it all clearly?" "No, I can't say that I do. I only gather that we are going to see the lady who is behind all this mischief." "Exactly. But does the name Isadora Klein convey nothing to you?"
Da, da, da.
Random name from a jar. Klein. Let's go see Klein. Oh, Doyle.
Isadora is, Chip, as you said, she's such a great character, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. It's a shame that it's wrapped in this story, but certainly if I was a person and I was a screenwriter or something like that, and I was looking for something that potentially could be interesting about Doyle writing a story,
this is the second half of this one. Yeah.
Well, you've got some bones here.
Exactly.
You've got some things you could grab hold of.
Yeah.
You could rewrite it. And certainly you could make this into a much stronger story.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah, I know. So this is the peer review portion of Tell Doyle how he could have written the Sherlock Holmes stories.
I'm sure he would be receptive to amateur helping him out here.
Oh, boy. You could imagine, just like Sherlock would just love to hear you explain how to do an investigation, Doyle would love to hear you explain how he wrote this wrong.
The weight of my comments certainly would have helped him.
But you guys, we're not wrong. Like, this is okay. But Isadora is a celebrated beauty. She is pure Spanish, the real blood of the masterful conquistadors. She married an aged German sugar king, which is kind of an interesting detail.
I am a sugar king, and I'm German.
First you get the sugar, then you get the women, then you get the power.
She has had many affairs, including with Douglas Maberly.
What?
attaché, right? Okay, so now, finally, we're connecting all these things together. Now, there's a really interesting reference here that Isadora Klein is the belle dame sans merci of fiction. Did you guys get that reference?
Oh, no. My God. I had no idea, but I knew it was French.
Well, actually, it's not. It's
Even better. It's like, oh, please, God. Let's expose his ignorance right now.
I mean, listen, obviously it's in the French language, but it's from John Keats, and it's one of my favorite romantic poems. La Belle Dame sans Merci is a poem of this wonderful, wicked woman who draws various knights into her, I don't know, like fantastic metaphorical space and kills them all. I'll just read you a moment. I'm sorry.
I don't think that sounds very enticing at all. That sounds scary.
It's a wonderfully scary poem. Oh, what can ail thee, knight at arms, alone and palely loitering? The sedge has withered from the lake, and no birds sing. So this, La Belle Dame sans Merci, she actually draws men into her space. I saw pale kings and princes too, pale warriors, death pale were they all. They cried, La Belle Dame sans Merci hath thee in thrall. Whew, I could keep reading, but I won't. It's so good. And so this reference to a kind of very seductive but terrifying woman who draws perfectly good men into her web and has them in thrall. And once they're in thrall, they can see all the other pale kings and pale princes who have been her victims in the past.
Hmm.
So that's the reference. Whew.
That's terrifying right there.
This is a good and, half and of the story.
It begins and ends with where no birds sing. Mm-hmm. So with like an apocalyptic feeling to the space that she brings you into, that imagined space. And so, whew, she's a really good character. Too bad we only meet her for like six paragraphs.
It'll be solved quickly. Holmes knows all.
So this manuscript, this novel that the man has been writing, he made two copies. One he sent to her, and one he was going to publish this book. Holmes tells her that she must give back the manuscript. She points to the fireplace and goes, yeah, I'll give it back, no problem. She's already burnt her copy, and obviously sent her henchman in to steal the other copy.
And don't you love how she says she's got a lot of pokers in this story, right? Like brandishing a poker earlier on.
There should be a brand name on it. That's how Disney would put it, so it could sell.
So Isadora, she like gestures with her poker. She says, "Shall I give this back?" she asked. So roguish and exquisite did she look as she stood before us with a challenging smile. That I felt, of all Holmes's criminals, this was the one whom he would find it hardest to face. However, he was immune from sentiment. So Watson opens up this door, right? Like, whew, this woman is dangerous, right? She's intriguing, she's exquisite, she's challenging, she's hard to face, but apparently Holmes is immune.
Well, he's so strong and so determined to solve a case.
Holmes is definitely on the case, definitely on a one-track mind. He doesn't notice women the same way that a normal person might, but this is a good half of a story here. Sherlock says, "I cannot promise to reciprocate, madam. I am not the law, but I represent justice so far as my feeble powers go. I am ready to listen, and then I will tell you how I will act." Okay, Batman. I am not the law, but I represent justice. Sheesh.
At that point, he put a blindfold on and held a book of laws up with a sword, and he became justice.
Now, and it's interesting, right? Because there's really the only crime that has occurred is the burglary of Mrs. Maberly's home. I mean, Isadora had an affair. Douglas fell for her. That's not criminal. He wrote a tell-all book. Not criminal. She didn't like it. She tried to steal it back. She burned her copy. Not criminal. The only thing she's done is tried to steal back the other copy. And she did steal it back. But, you know, a tell-all book, that's a hard thing to really blame someone for stealing. Do you know what I mean? It's so, in fact, what Holmes decides not to pursue a legal angle on this, and he remembers that retirement planning conversation he had with Mrs. Maberly, and he says to Isadora, how much money do you think it would cost for an elderly woman to take a beautiful trip around the world? She gives him a number. He's like, great, write me a check for that amount. And this brings us, Steve, you'll be happy to hear, to the ending of this story. So Sherlock says, very good. I think you will sign me a check for that, and I will see that it comes to Mrs. Maberly. You owe her a little change of air. Meantime, lady, he wagged a cautionary forefinger in this, like, Sherlock Holmes way.
Get off my lawn!
I love what he says to Isadora. He says, have a care, have a care. You can't play with edge tools forever without cutting those dainty hands.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, listen.
Ruined.
That right there, we for posterity.
Ruined.
Remember that.
There was a good mystery in the middle, or at the last two-thirds, but then you cannot play...
The last one-third, Steve. Let's not oversell it. The last...
You can't play with edge tools forever without cutting those dainty hands. Thanks, Doyle.
Maybe Sherlock noticed a little bit more than Watson gave him credit for. He was totally immune to Isadora's charms.
Oh, my goodness. Obviously, she was a lady who knew what she wanted, and she lived life.
And I agree that there is a good character there. There is a good adversary for Sherlock there. This is not a good representation of that mystery. That's all there is to it.
She'll have to come back in part two.
In Pastiches, I'm sure that there are some stories that have been told with this character. This is a well-drawn character in a terrible mystery. It's terrible. I don't like this at all. This is the third one?
Mm-hmm.
This is the third story from the casebook, and I'm done reading this book.
This is the fourth story. I think illustrious client was quite good, but then number 2, 3, 4 were not so fantastic. However, great news for tomorrow. We are going to be reading The Adventure of the Sussex Vampire.
All right, fine.
Oh, well, right. There you go. You get vampires.
You're enticing me. Fine. There's a vampire story tomorrow.
Is it going to be gothic? It's going to get
gothic. I hope it's gothic for Pam, because I think Pam likes gothic things.
What? How would you? What have I ever said that would make you think that? My goodness.
I hope everybody is enjoying this conversation at least and having fun with these adventures as we are having fun with them and listening carefully and ignoring the things that maybe aren't the best. But we'll get to the Sussex Vampire. We'll get to some gothic tomorrow. Give us a call or a text. We would love to hear from you. We would love to see your work. Follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes and go to our dedicated Sherlock Holmes website, sandwiches at irregularhours.com, for all of these fun conversations, and join us tomorrow as we get to something interesting. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Bedore, reminding you, do not play with edged tools. What I want to talk about is what I want to make you want, what I want to make